We get underway this afternoon in grand fashion by welcoming to the show a pair who've been telling the story of America through their documentaries for more than two decades now. Their newest collaboration, The Vietnam War, debuts on PBS in September. First, we welcome back to the show his fifth appearance with us here on Downtown. Ken Burns, it's great to have you back with us.
Thanks, Rich. Great to be back with you.
And for the first time on the program, a longtime collaborator with Ken, Lynn Novick joins us. Lynn, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, the Vietnam War, if we look back at it, it's been nearly 42 years since that last chopper left Saigon behind. Ken, let's start with you. Why haven't we in America been able to put Vietnam behind us?
I think that's the number one question. It is unfinished business for us. A lot of it has to do with the defeat, which stung. A lot of it had to do with the way, for a time, some of the veterans were received. Just the sort of difficulty of that war over, we believe, 30 years, beginning in 1945. We sort of think it's an early 60s thing. It's a little bit more complicated story that we try to tell. And it's time now, because so much of the divisions that we experience today sort of had their seed planted in Vietnam. And if we can unpack what really happened in Vietnam, and we've learned a lot of new scholarship, and we've talked to a lot of veterans, and we've also interviewed North Vietnamese and South Vietnamese folks to help triangulate this story. If we can unpack what really happened, we may be able to return to the more civil versions of ourselves.
Lynn, what would you add to that?
You know, I think it's a hugely traumatic experience. When soldiers go to war, we understand that that's a trauma. But I think the war was also traumatic at home because it became so unpopular as we began to question whether we could win it and whether we should be there. And for soldiers coming back into that debate, which became very, very heated, it was very painful. And we just haven't found a way to work our way through it. And part of it is, as Ken was saying, you know, we don't actually know what happened. If you live through it, you know what was going on around you and what you knew at the time. But it's a lot more complicated, and we felt one thing was very important for Americans was to fill in some missing pieces, which have been really obscure to us for the last 40-something years, which is, what was the war like for the Vietnamese, both the people who fought on the winning side and those on the losing side, the country that used to be called South Vietnam. And so we have worked very hard to hear from almost 100 people on all sides of the war, Americans who fought in it and who fought against it, and families who were torn apart by it, and families who'd lost somebody in the war, and Vietnamese on all sides. And it's a very complicated puzzle or mosaic. And we've found a lot of pieces and put them in an order that makes sense over 10 parts, 18 hours.
And I think it's remarkable, too, the work that goes into telling the story before American involvement. And people may be surprised to learn that Ho Chi Minh began the battle for independence by quoting Thomas Jefferson, and that he also reached out many times to President Harry Truman, but President Truman never got those letters.
Exactly, and this is one of the great tragedies. There's many, many instances when the primary sort of motivation for the Vietnamese resistance to the French and to the South Vietnamese government and to the Americans was essentially a desire for unification and independence. There were many opportunities along the way when we intersected in positive ways with Ho, or he was trying to reach out to us, beginning in 1919 with President Wilson, but most notably with Harry Truman, and we ended up in a Cold War proxy war siding with South Vietnam, and there's a lot of what ifs involved in that. But there, you know, no side is without blame. And what seems really clear is all three populations: the American population, the South Vietnamese population, and obviously the North Vietnamese population were not served by their government. There was not complete candor by their government. Their governments didn't tell them what happened or weren't completely honest about it. And particularly in a closed communist society like North Vietnam, they got nothing. They only got good news. They didn't get the sort of messiness of democracy. But it led to a great deal of divisions and confusions, which we've tried to sort out in this film, and done so through the heroic testimony of folks who were Americans who were climbing up hills and Americans who were, tending to the wounded, Americans that were POWs, but also Americans that were back home suffering, as Lynn said, as Gold Star families or as people beginning to say, hey, this war isn't right, and beginning to take to the streets, as is their democratic right, and protest. And so we try to put our arm around all these stories and don't make anybody wrong, create a space where all these various truths can coexist, and it'll help us, we hope, escape the kind of binary small p politics, the yelling and screaming that Lynn was talking about, and figure out how we might have a civil discourse today, not just about Vietnam, but who we are right now and why we seem to have made enemies of each other.
We're talking with Ken Burns and Lynn Novick here on Downtown, talking about their documentary, The Vietnam War, that debuts this September. For people of my age that grew up in the 60s and 70s who think of this as Lyndon Johnson's war and then Richard Nixon's war, the truth of it is, Lynn, that several presidents were a part of this process of getting us and keeping us involved there.
Yes, exactly. As Ken was saying, you really can go back to Truman and then Eisenhower and Kennedy, certainly, and, you know, for the bulk of our family, do focus on Johnson and Nixon, but you have to understand that for all of our leaders, there's many, many different calculuses that they're making. Part of it is that, you know, at least at first, they wanted to contain communism, the spread of communism in Asia, and maintain our reputation as one of the most powerful countries on earth, and that we were, you know, what we said, we would stand by our word and stand by our allies, but also domestic political considerations, getting reelected in a democracy, exerted an enormously powerful force. And so that determined a lot of decisions that they made and choices that they made and things that they did and didn't tell the public. And as Ken was saying, the lack of candor about the war and the unwillingness to share with the public what they really knew, and what we've seen in listening to audio tapes of intimate conversations with Johnson and his advisors and with Nixon and his advisors. You hear them wrestling with sort of the impossibility of the situation that we found ourselves in Vietnam, and then going out in public or on television saying the exact opposite. And it happens again and again and again.
And if only, as we look back at history, if only people had listened to one of the heroes that emerges from this, or potential heroes, the Undersecretary of State, George Ball.
Yes, well, when Johnson was wrestling with the question of whether or not to send U.S. combat troops and to really escalate our involvement and try to salvage what was becoming a deteriorating situation in South Vietnam, really teetering on the brink of falling to North Vietnam, they had many conversations in the White House about this, and George Ball was given the job, or, you know, took on the task of explaining why this was a bad idea, that we should not escalate, we should not send in ground troops. It was a recipe for disaster. We could never win. We would get bogged down, and the American public would tire of it. And he made his case, and then everybody else went the other way, and Johnson made the opposite decision.
Ken, your films always also manage to tell us history that we think we know through the lives of everyday mm-hmm. Americans. What drew you to the incredible, powerful story of Mogi Crocker?
Well, it's just an extraordinary one. He's, a kid that grows up in university towns and ends up spending most of his childhood in Saratoga Springs, where his dad is teaching at Skidmore. And we follow his exploits over the course of two episodes as told by his mother and his sister. And it's just a particularly ordinary, and then, of course, because there's no such thing as that, particularly in war, a very extraordinary story. And we invite you to get to know Mogi Crocker and his mother and his sister, and indeed other members of his family, and standing in for many, many other families in America who went through the kinds of hardships and agonies and decisions and doubts and reversals and letters and all of the things that personalized the war. It's hugely important that we not be distracted in this film by the boldface names. As Lynn suggested, we're going to get to know all those presidents from the top down. But we're not interviewing the familiar faces. We're interviewing the kid from the Ozark mountain area of Missouri. We're interviewing a Kansas kid and a Roxbury Boston kid who go to the Marines and experience experience things. So what we try to do is make the people who populate our film, and that extends also to the Vietnamese, the South Vietnamese civilians and soldiers that we interviewed, the Viet Cong guerrillas who were fighting against us, the North Vietnamese soldiers that were fighting against us, the North Vietnamese civilians who were experiencing that regime and the lack of real candor and clarity from their government. They will be all authentic and familiar to all of us. They speak to us in direct, really human ways, and they communicate the most important part of the story, which is that in all wars, it's the individuals, it's the so-called ordinary people who do the fighting and the dying, and it's their stories we need to remember, it's their stories we need to honor, and it's their stories we need to carry back and try to divine the lessons from this story. And I think in many ways we've done that in this film, and we can't wait to share it with you all starting Sunday, September 17th, when PBS has an unprecedented rollout of it. If you work late, you can see it early. If you go to bed, you can see it late. If you get home, you can see it as a marathon. You can stream it. You can get the DVDs. I mean, they've really done a bang-up job.
Hi, Ken. This is Bruce Pratt. I had a quick question for you. I was in Vietnam a few years ago as a tourist. I was not there in the service, though. I'm of that age, and people assumed there that I was coming back as a returning soldier. One of the things that I found the North, particularly, no, I was only in the North, is how many Vietnamese looked at us, what are you mad at? Why were you mad at us? How did this all begin? Did you find that to be true of a lot of the people in the North?
I'll let Lynn answer that. She had some really extraordinary experiences.
Yeah, we were never asked that question. And the thing that struck us, and I think strikes many Americans when they go to Vietnam, is that the lack of rancor and bitterness towards us, given that our country did cause enormous damage there. In the name of doing something to help the Vietnamese people, millions of people died, not all because of us, but nonetheless, we were part of it. And we found the Vietnamese people incredibly warm and welcoming and open and interested in Americans and America and in our values and in our way of life and in our democracy and all of that. And so, and obviously in our popular culture, which, that's true around the world. So, it's a very young country. It's a very vibrant country. It's an extraordinarily resilient country. And, I think many people who do know about the war, having lived through it, understand and feel quite strongly that it was the American government that made decisions, but the ordinary American people really, don't bear responsibility for that particularly. And so, therefore, on a human level and on an individual level, they really like to connect with Americans.
We're talking with Lynn Novick.
Welcome there.
Lynn Novick and Ken Burns here on Downtown. The episode that just took my breath away involved Joe Musgrave. And he told the story of the first person he killed in Vietnam and then went on to explain how he rationalized things. And this quote stays with me. He talked about racism being, as he said, a very necessary tool when you have children fighting your wars.
Well, just think about it. You've got an impressionistic teenager, who feels invincible and immortal, as most of the late teenagers do. And they volunteer, as their fathers had done in World War II, and they were going to Vietnam. And they find themselves in an incredibly different kind of situation, in a very, very different kind of climate, with a different language and a different culture and different religions. And the only way you can sort of, as he says, stay sane doing what you're doing, and let's not sugarcoat what the duty of a soldier is to do, and that's kill the enemy, is to essentially reduce them, to turn them into something subhuman, to make them less than that. And the way you can, as he says, when to have your children fighting your wars, you need to, he says, it's racism 101. That's what you have to do, is dehumanize them.
Lynn, one of the veterans early in the documentary says, we were the last generation of kids who believed our government wouldn't lie to us. Will processing this 40 plus years later help us get closer to getting back to that point somehow?
I'm not sure about that. I think, in a way, one of the things that came out of the Vietnam War that maybe was a good thing and that'll be a question for our country to talk about and think about once the film comes out, but is that maybe we should have a little bit more, not skepticism per se, but we should just question, you know, our leaders, do they know what they're doing? Are they up to the job? Are they competent? Are they principled, moral? Do they, you know, do they have the country's best interest at heart? And are they telling us the truth? And those questions really were not raised in a systemic way, in a sustained way, until the Vietnam War sort of unraveled toward the end of the war. It became very, very clear with the release of the Pentagon Papers, particularly, but leading up to that as well, there was a growing sense that maybe we're not really being told the full story, as Ken was saying. And so, you know, that's maybe healthy for a democracy, that, you know, our government should earn our respect and our loyalty and should not just expect it on sort of a knee-jerk basis. And so, you know, that we should just hold their feet to the fire and make sure that they do tell us the truth and that we do understand why they're making the decisions that they're making and that we're not being misled. So I think that's something we think that, yeah. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just saying, and yet, Rich, you know, your question is really a central one because, of course, what we've seen in the 40-plus years since the end of the Vietnam War is that skepticism through the proliferation of all the websites and all the internet and the various politically oriented cable shows and other things and fake news is that healthy skepticism that Lynn is talking about has also been replaced by a kind of conspiracy theory that's not based on any real stuff or stuff that is generally accepted by the mainstream. And then, in fact, the mainstream is, in fact, criticized for being just that. And what you end up is fraying the tapestry of our community and the things that bind us together as a community. And we begin to say that the people who don't agree with us are our enemy. Rather than being the fundamental right of a democracy is to disagree and then to compromise in the course of working out those disagreements. And so, you know, one hopes that, you know, I don't think you ever get the genie back into the bottle that perhaps Vietnam released. But I think talking about it, as Lynn suggests, having the kind of courageous conversations I think we have to have after the show is broadcast about these questions, hopefully will bring us closer together and not the opposite, not send us in the knee-jerk fashion that we do now to whatever political corner we feel most comfortable in and then fight from there. But to begin to see, as I was saying earlier, that there may be a possibility that more than one truth and maybe even many truths exist at the same time, and it would be possible to extend to the other a sense that the reality that they have, the eyes through which they see, the things that they believe could be as equally valid as what I see and what I believe and what I perceive, to, in essence, not make the other wrong, as we do in almost every gesture in our political conversation today. And I think we can shed that.
Hi, Carrie Haskell here. Lynn, very early in the first episode of the series, there's a comment from a Marine veteran, Carl Marlantis, part of which is nobody talked about Vietnam. And I've found that true of the people that I've known that have served in Vietnam. What was the process like to get the veterans especially to open up about their experiences in Vietnam?
You know, I think he continues in that comment to say, but he thinks the baby boomers are starting to look back and ask what happened. And we found that to be absolutely true, that maybe enough time has passed. And so it's still, the memories are very fresh and in some cases very raw, but that the veterans we spoke with were eager to talk about the war. And that's not true of every single veteran. There were certainly some people we met who, you know, decided they didn't want to participate. But for the most part, I think it has to do with the passage of time and where, not where we are right now in this moment in our country, but, you know, we started working on the film 10 years ago. Most of the interviews were conducted around 2011, 2012. You know, we have, at that point, we're already involved in several other wars, asymmetrical wars that had been grinding on. And so they were feeling resonances with their own experiences and wondering, you know, have we learned the lessons of Vietnam? And maybe if I could share my story, maybe that would shed some light on where we are now and what happened then. And I think they were, you know, generally very eager. And I think we felt that over time, you know, Ken and I have sat down with many people and heard their stories, and there's something of, they're carrying a very heavy weight. from not talking about it, and that there's maybe letting up a little bit of that burden by sharing it. And it sounds like a cliche, but it really is true. We just felt that over and over and over again, that they could let go a little bit of the sometimes very traumatic and painful stories, memories, experiences that they have lived with all this time. It was maybe, you know, a very productive and positive experience to share those stories with us.
So before we let you go, Ken, do we know at this point, all these decades out, what the lessons are and should be from Vietnam?
Well, I think the lessons are many and varied, and one of them we've certainly learned is that we're never going to blame the warriors again, as we did for a period of time before even the anti-war movement wised up and suddenly realized that this was the failure, if they believe that, of policymakers and not of the soldiers. So we've learned something. We tried in the first Desert Storm war to apply some of the lessons. There are many, many lessons. I think that Lynn and I would, rather than preach to you, as so many documentaries do, about what you should believe about something politically or what you should know, we'd rather share with you our experience of discovery, because so much of what people believe about Vietnam is either not true or outdated, and we can prove that in thousands of ways throughout the series, and then permit the rest of us to come to whatever lessons that they think we can take for them, because we're confident that with folks informed by real facts, and we've spent 10 years trying to verify these facts, that we feel safe in saying, you know, this is the way we believe it happened, and I'm sure we'll have people will point out some mistakes, and that's not an F4 Phantom, this is a this. But what we've tried earnestly to do is set the conditions for Americans of whatever political orientation they have, whatever age they are, whether they live through it or are, you know, completely unfamiliar with it because they're so young, would have an opportunity to be shaped by this and come to their own conclusions. And so besides saying hallelujah to the fundamental lesson that we are not going to blame the warriors anymore, then we'll leave it up to everybody else to sort of see. This is an immense tragedy, and also what happens in tragedy is that you find that two opposite things can coexist at the same time, and that's what you have to do in life, and we hope in an understanding of the Vietnam War.
Well, it's a remarkable film, and as someone who teaches history and now seeing, and it makes me feel old to think about it, but seeing high school students whose grandparents are Vietnam veterans
and who
know so little about the war, I can't wait for America to see this film and to begin that conversation with a new generation.
Thank you so much. We appreciate all the time and the thoughtfulness of your questions, and thanks so much for watching it. We really appreciate it, and we can't wait for your listeners to do the same in September.
Thank you so much. Ken, Lynn, we appreciate you being with us, and always thrilled to talk to you, Ken, yet again. And Lynn, we hope to have you back down the road as well. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Wonderful.
Ken Burns, bye-bye. Lynn Novick, The Vietnam War debuts September 17th on PBS.